Not for the first time, President Trump made remarks that left people wondering what he really meant.
This time, it was an interview on NBC's Meet the Press with Kristen Welker. The president celebrated the tariffs that he regularly changes. He said they could be permanent, although he's claiming the power to impose them by saying there's an emergency. He also said, "I don't know," when asked if he needs to uphold the Constitution.
NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid was listening. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so what exactly did the president say about the Constitution on NBC?
Well, the context for this was a series of questions about whether non-citizens in the U.S. deserve due process. The president believes, frankly, he has a mandate, he thinks, on immigration, and said if you talk about due process for people who are not in the country legally, you'd have to deal with millions of trials. And he was pressed on this by the show's moderator, Kristen Welker.
Even given those numbers that you're talking about, don't you need to uphold the Constitution of the United States as president?
I don't know. I have to respond by saying again, I have brilliant lawyers that work for me, and they are going to obviously follow what the Supreme Court said.
The backdrop to this is the high-profile case of a man who was sent from Maryland to El Salvador, despite a court order saying he should specifically not be deported there. The Supreme Court has called on the U.S. government to facilitate his return, but thus far he remains in El Salvador. And one last related point, Steve, here, is that last night Trump said he's ordering the federal government to reopen and rebuild one of America's most notorious prisons, Alcatraz. He told reporters he wants to do this because of radical judges who've been insisting on due process for people in the country illegally. Though we should remind folks, this prison, Alcatraz, is now a tourist attraction. It actually hasn't operated as a prison in decades.
Yeah, it had to be closed because it was falling apart. Did the president make any news on the economy, Asma?
You know, there were a couple of things that caught my ear, particularly when the moderator asked the president if tariffs are here to stay for the long run.
You're not taking the possibility that these tariffs could be permanent off the table, some of them.
Oh, I wouldn't do that, because if somebody thought they were going to come off the table, why would they build in the United States?
At one point, Trump also seemed to say that he'd be okay with a short-term recession because he believes the economy will be fantastic in the long run. But his optimism does not match economic data or consumer sentiment at this point.
We're getting to the contradiction of the entire tariff policy, aside from the legality of whether it's even legal what the president is claiming to do on a permanent basis now. He likes tariffs. He wants permanent tariffs. He also talks about negotiating away the tariffs in exchange for other benefits. Is the administration trying to make deals?
I mean, the president told reporters on Air Force One yesterday that there could be some trade deals this week. But at the same time, Steve, he also suggested that this broad tariff dynamic is not an actual negotiation. He said at the end of the day, he will set the terms of these tariff deals because he sets the deals. Other countries do not. You know, tariffs are key to the president's economic vision. In fact, just last night on social media, he announced plans for yet another tariff, this time 100% tariff rate on movies produced outside of the United States. You know, one last thing to note, Steve, is that this week, Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney is coming to Washington. It is a high-stakes meeting to watch, given Trump's threats of tariffs and, of course, annexation toward the United States' northern neighbor.
NPR's Asma Khalid with reporting and analysis made right here in the United States. Asma, thanks so much.
Good to speak with you.
Israel is planning to limit the way that food and supplies are distributed in Gaza.
Israel says it is the only way it will allow any food back into Gaza, where people are going hungry. An Israeli official says it's part of a plan to take over more territory and expand the war. The main aid groups in Gaza, including the United Nations, are refusing to take part.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is covering this story in Tel Aviv. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
What exactly is the plan?
Israel's cabinet approved it last night, and it completely changes how the 2 million people of Gaza would get their food and their basic supplies. I got details from five people, including officials with knowledge of this plan. Each one of them spoke on condition of anonymity because the details have not been officially released, and it's very sensitive. But it's a plan to shut down hundreds of community kitchens and food distribution points across Gaza, and instead, Israel would allow for just around 4 to 10 designated aid centers in southern Gaza.
Okay, limited number of aid centers. Who would run them?
Well, the centers are supposed to be run by an American security contractor in coordination with a new foundation recently established in Switzerland that we know very little about. Israeli soldiers would not run them, but they would guard the periphery of this zone. And Palestinians would be coming to these places, registered and screened through facial recognition technology. They'd pick up parcels for their family. Israel says this whole operation is an attempt to isolate aid from Hamas and to weaken the group. And an Israeli official tells us it's actually part of a bigger strategy to get Palestinian civilians to move en masse to a smaller, more consolidated area of Gaza so that the military can expand the territory that it's taking over in Gaza. And the army is already starting to call up more soldiers.
Thanks for that bit of reporting. What are aid groups and the United Nations saying as they reject this plan?
They put out a statement together and they say basically this is not an acceptable aid plan. It's a military plan. They say you cannot use life-saving supplies to achieve military goals. They also say that large groups of people will simply struggle to reach these new aid centers. So think pregnant women or the elderly. So what we're seeing is this serious standoff over the very basic necessities of life. And it's happening at a time of extreme desperation in Gaza. Israel has been banning food and supplies, everything, for more than 2 months into Gaza. This is the longest full blockade it has ever imposed. So bakeries are closed, food kitchens are closed. Hunger is widespread.
Daniel, you said something about an American contractor being part of this. Is the United States on board?
Very good question. The Trump administration has not commented specifically on this plan, but President Trump has said that food needs to get into Gaza. He is coming to the region next week. I should note that a former U.S. official told me that Israel actually tried to implement a version of this aid plan under the Biden administration's tenure, but the Biden administration said no. According to the international laws of war, it said that anyone who needs aid must get aid. You cannot vet. You cannot fight a war through manipulating humanitarian aid. That's what the Biden administration said, but Trump has not made the same demands on Israel.
One bit of news from the weekend, there was a big bomb crater that I saw outside Israel's airport. What happened?
Yesterday, the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen fired a missile at Israel. Israel failed to intercept it, and it landed around Israel's international airport near Tel Aviv. More than a dozen airlines have canceled flights. And the Houthis in Yemen say that they will continue to target Israel because Israel is expanding its offensive in Gaza. The Houthis say that the U.S. struck targets in Yemen overnight, and Israel is vowing to strike back too.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right, the trial of Sean Diddy Combs begins in New York today.
The record executive, rapper, and businessman has been in federal custody since his arrest last September. He faces charges that include sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. He's pleaded not guilty.
NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento is covering the trial for NPR in New York, and this report lasts about 3 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Many people have followed this blow by blow, but what exactly is Combs on trial for?
Yeah, I mean, he's on trial for a number of alleged activities that center on the abuse of women and others around him. So prosecutors are basically alleging that Combs used his significant power and his business empire to protect himself from the repercussions of those actions. So for one, he faces charges of sex trafficking. That means forcing or coercing someone to engage in commercial sex acts. Aya Gruber is a criminal law professor at the University of Southern California, and she says that especially after the trials of Harvey Weinstein and the NXIVM cult case, the legal definition of commercial sex is quite broad.
Courts are willing to define commercial sex as an exchange of sex, not just for money, but for anything of value.
So, for example, promising to help someone's career could potentially be considered something of value in some instances. Combs also faces charges for transporting people across state lines to participate in commercial sex. And the third charge, racketeering conspiracy, is what ties all of this together. Prosecutors allege that Combs directed his employees to organize and conceal these sex crimes for over a decade, and Combs has pleaded not guilty to all of these charges.
How do these criminal charges relate to the civil sexual assault lawsuits that Combs also faces?
You know, the civil law and the criminal law are two completely different systems. But there is a lot of overlap in the behavior described here. So you're absolutely right. Combs faces dozens of civil lawsuits. Some listeners might be familiar with the R&B singer Cassie Ventura, who filed the first prominent civil lawsuit against him. But that's not necessarily what this trial is about. He's really only on trial for the criminal charges in the indictment that we just discussed. However, there is a chance that some of the alleged victims who filed civil suits have also been cooperating with this criminal investigation. So even though there are two different legal roads when it comes to Sean Combs, there could be some intersecting here.
And we have this question now that comes up whenever somebody who's extremely famous is put on trial. How do you select a jury for a case like this where so many people have probably heard something about it?
Yeah, I mean, Combs is from New York City and he's a huge star. So there's really a high chance that potential jurors here will already have some opinions about this case. Both the prosecution and the defense submitted proposed questionnaires for what they'd like the jury to be asked. Combs' team included questions about how jurors feel about wealthy celebrities, what kind of music they listen to, and how they might respond to evidence that, you know, describes people engaging in sexual relations with multiple partners. On the prosecution side, several of their key witnesses are alleged victims who will be testifying against Combs under pseudonyms. So the prosecution also proposed asking whether jurors would be more or less likely to believe a witness who testifies under a different name.
Really interesting. So if he is convicted, how long could he go to prison?
So Sean Combs has been in custody since he was arrested in September. He's been denied bail multiple times. And if he's found guilty of all of these charges, he could be spending the remainder of his life behind bars.
Man in his mid-50s. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, thanks so much.
Thank you.